Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Cape Up, diversity training. A lot of employees go through it. A lot of companies make their employees do it. But in her book, Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business, Pamela Newkirk argues that not only is diversity training done wrong, it can also make things worse in any profession. This conversation was a book talk at Politics and Prose here in Washington, D.C. earlier this month. Find out how ignorance of history exacerbates the problem and what all that money should be spent on to truly make things better right now. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. And I'm going to be doing a lot of juggling. I think we'll both be doing a lot of juggling because I've got my iPad and I've got your book. And there's so much in this book. If you have not read it yet, actually, a show of hands. How many of you have already read White Fragility? How many of you have already read White Rage? Okay, so if you've read both of those books, then Pamela Newkirk's book, Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business, is going to be another puzzle piece in these two books. In actually this genre, which is very, very important. The first time I ever heard, Pamela, that diversity training was actually detrimental, was not achieving the goal that it set out to, was when I interviewed another journalist who wrote a book about women in the workplace, whose name is escaping me right now. Interviewed her for my podcast, and I was just very surprised by what she was telling me, that diversity training was actually harming women in the workplace.
Right.
And now here comes your book that also says, yeah, diversity training is harming people of color, African Americans in particular, in the workplace. Why is such a failed business a billion-dollar business in the United States?
Well, that was the question that prompted my journey to try to figure out, why are companies spending billions of dollars of something that clearly has not moved the needle nearly enough over the past five decades? We had seen tremendous progress in the 1970s, and much of that progress was either stalled or was erased during the Reagan administration. And then there's been a steady dismantlement of many of the measures that had borne fruit, that had begun to close the economic and educational gaps, particularly between blacks and whites. And then, you know, things just kind of stopped. And yet we had this delusion around being this post-race society as the dismantlement of measures continued. You know, whether it's the Voting Rights Act, or, you know, just, you know, policies to increase diversity in universities, everything was under attack. And so here we are with numbers that are certainly bleak. And I don't think there's a full acknowledgement of what has happened over the past few decades that has resulted in numbers that look, you know, in tech, blacks are like 2-3%. You know, you pick a field, mm-hmm. pick any influential field, an outfield in journalism.
Oh, yeah.
You know, diversity has been a preoccupation of our industry for decades, and yet the numbers for African Americans, for Latinos, for Asians are still really, really low. And so, but yet, companies are investing billions of dollars every year, largely to pay for measures that have been proven to fail.
Well, is that our business is paying for this because what they really want to do, and I'm trying to find, because I've taken, if you've seen me do these interviews before, you know I've got the book and I've got the page numbers and all of that. And I can't find the page number for this, where you either quoting someone or you state flat out that businesses, yeah, they'll do the diversity training, but it's not to actually get anything done. It is to check the box. It's to show that they're just trying to do something without actually doing something.
Right. And here I will recognize Cyrus Merry, who I had the honor of spending a lot of time with researching this book. And Cyrus litigated a number of landmark discrimination lawsuits, including
him.
Yeah, that's that's the man.
Wait, Coca-Cola.
Against Coca-Cola, Texaco. He is responsible for the NFL's Rooney Rule along with Johnny Cochran. So anyway, it's Cyrus who I quote who called many of the efforts by companies drive-by diversity.
Yes, that was drive-by diversity.
So he, you know, what he said is you know, that everyone wants to do the climate surveys and the, you know, whatever, but they don't want to do the interventions. And that's what we see. We see companies doing the exact same thing year after year, having disappointing results. Rinse, repeat. They do it again.
When you say the interventions, what are the interventions that they should be doing?
Well, the case study that I cite in one chapter is Coca-Cola. What happened after the settlement of that discrimination lawsuit, they actually looked at the metrics across the company, everything that involved an employee, from who was being interviewed for a job, who was being promoted, who was getting bonuses. They looked at everything, and they looked at it across racial and gender lines, and they were able to both detect and disrupt patterns of bias, patterns of inequities, which had prompted the lawsuit to begin with. And over a period of 5 years, they were able to close those gaps. So, I mean, it required intention, it required, you know, vigilance, but it shows that with that kind of intention, you can act, and commitment, you can actually do it.
And that gets to something else that you write about towards the end of the book, and that is the whole when companies are challenged about the fact that they don't have a representative workforce, the response is always, but you know, the pipeline.
Right.
There isn't a pipeline
right.
For us to hire.
Right. And there have been so many studies that have conclusively shown that the pipeline is no longer the issue. That's the issue that was cited in the 1960s when many of the professions that had long been closed off to African-Americans and other people of color, the doors finally were pried open. And then people say, yeah, but the pipeline. And then all of these training programs were created. And even journalists who had worked in, you know, black media, who were highly trained, who were well educated, even they were put through training programs to before they could take a job, an entry level job at, you know, a mainstream newspaper. So the pipeline issue has been with us for 50 years and counting, and yet you can see just legions of African Americans, Latinos, and others graduating from many of the most prestigious schools in this country, who were not being hired at the same rate to work in these professions in which they're acutely underrepresented.
One of the things that happened as you were talking about the sort of attacks on advancement, particularly during the Reagan administration, but there are also, you write about this, but also in White Rage, Carol Anderson writes about the backlash via the Supreme Court.
Precisely.
On affirmative action, all of the cases that chipped away at affirmative action. And you have a quote from Lee Bollinger, president of Columbia University, on page 132, where he, you write, Bollinger concedes that fear of lawsuits has caused university leaders to shy away from placing diversity in the context of justice. And you quote him as saying, I would urge everyone to say it because it needs to be said. I think we've allowed this loss of memory to take hold and the people who oppose it to set the agenda. And he goes on to say, if anything, the trend is moving toward a flattened diversity for all mantle that embraces diversity of all kinds while ignoring the history and legacy of structural racial disadvantage baked into the educational system. Now, he's talking about the educational system, but just take out educational system.
Precisely.
And add in anything else, and this is a blanket warning.
Right. Right. And I mean, he's been at the forefront of this movement since he was president of the University of Michigan, where he was named in two lawsuits claiming reverse discrimination by white students who were denied admission.
Well, those two of those cases went to the Supreme Court.
Both of them went to the Supreme Court, and it was like a split decision. In one case, they upheld diversity as a compelling interest for schools, and the other, they basically kind of wiped out race as one of the tools you could use for admissions. Yeah.
I bring that up because you write about, in addition to Coca-Cola and Texaco, you write about them at length. You go into the ins and outs of these cases that were involved. But then there's the case of the person at Apple. Who was she? The
Our sister?
Yes.
You mean the African-American woman.
Right.
Who was the chief diversity officer.
Right. And what did she say? Tell everyone what she said.
I've heard this before, so she's not the first one I've heard describe diversity. She pretty much said that she gets annoyed when people attach diversity to, like, blacks and Latinos. Diversity can be a white man with blue eyes. Diversity could be, and on and on. Yeah.
Yeah. And what happened to her?
Yeah.
What ended up happening to her?
She didn't last.
She was there for less than a year, and she was gone not much longer after that event.
Right.
So we've been talking at the 35,000 foot level about this, but what is terrific about your book is don't be lulled into thinking that this is just a book about business and business being bad at diversity. You dive in the way that both Carol Anderson does in White Rage and Robin DiAngelo does in White Fragility in talking about the underlying reasons why diversity trainings don't work. And
right.
It's because there are a lot of blind spots. And you write on page 85, and it gets to this notion of the different ways African-Americans and whites view race.
Right.
And you write, it no longer, let's see, moreover, he revealed the blind spot that many whites, left and right, have when it comes to the ways of 21st century bias. It no longer requires the horse, tear gas, and dogs weaponized in Bull Connor's day. Videotaped scenes of brutalized civil rights protesters have been replaced by images of fleeing or handcuffed blacks being shot or choked by police, often with impunity, along with the racial profiling and mass incarceration of black and brown men. While racial customs and decorum in public settings have radically changed, the deep-seated prejudices many whites hold of black and brown people have apparently not. And you go on to give examples, but there's another part in here where you talk about how whites view racism as discrete individual actions, whereas people of color, African Americans in particular, view race and racism as a structure, as a system,
precisely,
that we have to navigate and push back against.
Right.
I was going to say on a daily basis, but it's probably hourly. Right.
Yeah. I would say.
So dive into that more. Why was it important for you to
just talk about what institutions are doing to diversify without talking about the social context in which they're attempting to do this, it makes the whole thing so abstract, right? But you have to understand the social context of, Jonathan getting up in the morning and going to work, and then what happens, like all of those, you know, you have to connect the dots. So things like, and this is sounding abstract, because that's why it's a book and not an article, because there's so much context that's needed to even have this discussion. But, you know, we have to look at media portrayals. We have to look at school curricula. We have to look at, there are so many ways in which white America in particular, but others as well, understand African Americans or think they understand African Americans. And until you really have that wraparound view of what actually is going on, these diversity efforts, it's like putting lipstick on a pig. It's like you have to understand that we're still up against these demeaning images of African Americans that were created, codified, legitimized by all of our major institutions, from higher ed to elementary school to museums, literature. Like, if you don't understand the ways in which African Americans have been demonized in this country, then you don't understand what we're talking about when we say Black Lives Matter. You don't understand, you know, why these diversity initiatives don't work. You have to, like, really have a sense of what it is that we're actually experiencing.
You have a quote in here from British director Sage. His first name
is Michonne Sage.
British filmmaker, where he, you quote him as saying, "People want diversity as long as they don't have to do it."
Yeah.
A lot of the times, they want our physical presence, but not our voice. And I underlined it. I underlined the asterisk. Because, I mean, I related to that, because I can't tell you how many times.
Oh, especially in the newsroom.
In my profession, you know, it's the presence, great, glad you're here. But the moment you open your mouth.
Right. There's pushback.
If there's pushback, there might be little twitches.
Discomfort.
You know, please hurry up. Finish talking, that kind of thing. But how do you, that gets to the larger issue of back to diversity training. So you have these companies doing this training that they don't want to do, that is box checking. And you have employees, let's say this was a diversity training going on right now, where the white people in the audience, I'm overly generalizing, I know that, where the white people might be annoyed about the fact that, well, why do I have to do this? But then you have the African Americans, people of color, African Americans in particular, who are uncomfortable and might not feel empowered or comfortable because of their livelihood, saying to a fellow coworker,
precisely,
here's this thing that you did or you said that was problematic.
Yeah, it's problematic. and it also assumes that you can train people in a few hours to undo centuries worth of damage that's been done. It assumes that, first of all, where is that curriculum that can actually make a difference in the way people feel about
each other? Is there one?
I don't know. I would love to see it.
I was going to say, I mean, if there was one, it would, be in here.
An effective one. But what those training sessions have been found to do is trigger a backlash and resentment, particularly by white men. And it's not helpful. And some studies have shown that the percentage of Black women in particular go down after you have these diversity training sessions, probably because of all of the tension that they create.
I mean, just by the argument you just made, I mean, if the Washington Post were to say you have to go to diversity training.
Oh, my God. I'm sick that day.
I'm out. I have to be in New York. Not that that's going to be any better, because then that's the other job. That's the MSNBC job. Which, I mean, as you write about Hollywood, you write about academia, you write about business, you write about journalism, how all of these institutions, as you were saying before, don't get it right. Either don't realize they're not getting it right, or don't care that they're not getting it right.
Maybe. Yeah.
Why did you say well?
Well, I don't think, I don't think they're, at this point, they don't realize that they're not getting it right. Unless they're really in denial about the state of race in this country. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like serious denial.
Well, I mean, there's one realizing you're not getting it right, and then you bring in the diversity trainer,
right.
And then you're wondering
what to do. Right.
Right. It's
right.
What comes next.
Right. It's what to do. You know, the good news in this book, and there is good news, people, is that there are models. There are successful models, partly due to a few of the people in this room. There's three of them. Oh, I never met you in person, but I interviewed him. He was the global chief diversity officer at Coca-Cola.
You're that guy.
He's that guy Steve Bucciarati, who oversaw the transformation of the workplace. And I mean, he had just wonderful anecdotes and, you know, descriptions. He said something like, you know, in doing these interventions in real time, he wanted to do, he didn't want to do forensics. He wanted to do triage, which is like to actually work on it before the body is dead. and it was just an amazing thing. Pam Kukos, who also works with Cyrus, I mean, they helped create models that have been proven to work.
Triage. But it also requires, as you were saying before, it requires vigilance and intentionality.
Commitment. You have to be serious about this.
But are there enough people serious?
Well, we haven't seen evidence of that. No, we haven't seen evidence of that, but maybe it's because they don't know. And if they see what they can do differently. I quoted Pam saying at one point, people are really committed to the way they do things, even if it doesn't, like, you know, mm-hmm. if it's not successful, they just keep doing that thing. And they think it's part of the intentional discrimination. Like, if you keep doing the same thing and expect different results, either you're crazy or maybe you really don't want results.
Because you know that this doesn't work, so just keep doing it so it doesn't
work. Yeah.
I want to close. I want to get you to talk this piece out further. You brought your glasses. Did you bring your glasses? Here, I'll have you read it. I'm not going to read your book.
What am I going to read?
This underline asterisk thing here.
See, this is, he read this book. I love this. So, this is how I read books.
So this paragraph here.
Okay. If diversity is to flower, it cannot be hermetically sealed off from the cultural ecosystem in which it is implanted. It must be rooted in a mutual understanding of our past and its profound legacy. Viewing America through rose-colored lenses has prevented most white Americans from coming to terms with the myriad ways in which race continues to pervert national ideals and undermine justice. Without truthful encounters with the past, racial reconciliation is doubtful, and diversity will remain little more than a hollow abstraction.
So if you could give one piece of advice, or maybe two, to a business. Let's say Tim Cook called you up and said,
"Hey,
you know,
Tim,
we've got some issues."
Yeah.
And we need to deal with fill in the blank diversity issue. What would you advise him? What would you tell him? Here's the one thing you really should do.
Other than just like call either Steve Bucciarati or Cyrus Merry, who like have created the systems that work, I would say, well, first, if you're seriously committed, stop doing what you've been doing because it doesn't work. And then look at some of the models that have worked. And I mean, it's really that simple. Just like change course. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably the hardest thing for major institutions to do, right? Because they're rooted in systems and they just keep doing it. But I don't know if they would invest billions of dollars in the kind of failure in other realms of their business. Like, I just don't know. It just seems like, you know, like, wouldn't you just say, well, this is not working? Shouldn't heads roll? Like, is there accountability? Like, who's doing this? Who's responsible? Where does the buck stop? And if it's Tim Cook, if it stops with him, then, like, what are you doing? Right.
Right. So you have all these people. It's $1 billion business.
Right.
You have all of these people going into this failed business. And a prime example, not because she's a terrible person, but it sort of exemplifies just how much a demand there is and how easy it is to jump in. April Rain, who is the one who coined just in
Oscar
one tweet,
so white.
Oscar's so white.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing she knows, and she's not, and what I found interesting is that I learned through your book, she's not in Hollywood. She wasn't involved in a studio.
She was an election lawyer.
Yeah. She was just someone who saw the nominations, did hashtag Oscar's so white.
Went to work,
and then all of a sudden she's getting called for interviews and things. And you quote her saying, like, she had to bone up on film history and Hollywood in order to do these interviews. And now what is she doing?
She's a diversity consultant. It's a lot of money in it. And you don't, like, there are people who know what to do because they've done it, like a Steve Bucciarati in a company. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who, you know, opportunity calls, and they can just do it. Hang out that shingle. I'm a diversity consultant.
And I know this is a failed business, but is that a bad thing?
there is
a need
for diversity.
Correct.
Not for a multi-billion-dollar apparatus around diversity. Like, imagine if the multi-billions were spent on getting diversity, hiring people, training people. Like, imagine what could happen if that money was directed mm-hmm. in more fruitful ways.
Actually, right. And that's actually a point that you make in the book. All that money being spent, you know, why not push that into actually going to the pipeline that actually does exist,
right,
and bring people in, and not just hiring people. Once you hire folks, then the next step is, how do you support them?
Right.
And make sure that.
Right. And some of these things don't cost money. It's like mentoring is probably one of the most successful ways to sustain a diverse staff. Like, to you know, ensure the success of the people you've hired, you invest in their growth. Like, you don't need a major diversity apparatus to mentor people. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
Or to just say, hey, good job.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
One last question before I throw it up open to Q&A. And you don't write about any of this in your book. I'm just asking because you're here. You do write about newsroom diversity. And I'm wondering, from your vantage point, or even your own personal opinion, do you think the lack of newsroom diversity is hampering the campaigns of specifically Kamala Harris, Cory Booker? And was that lack of newsroom diversity something that in some ways hindered Hillary Clinton in 2016, but focus on
that's an interesting
Kamala
question.
Harris, yeah. Because I've been seeing on my Twitter feed over the last few days, especially after her speech at the Iowa dinner, which was terrific, a lot of people wondering, why aren't you covering
right.
her? Why are you silencing black women?
And it's interesting, you know, because in political reporting, the White House press corps is probably one of the least diverse realms in all of American journalism, right? Mm-hmm. And that's long been the case. And political reporting has always been, you know, considered the plum assignment that has eluded many people of color. And of course, it has an impact on how candidates of color are portrayed, or if they're covered. Mm-hmm. If there's a real knowledge of some of the issues that would be important to their base. So, yeah, I mean, but, you know, it's not just journalism. What I found in this book, that all of the fields that are considered the most progressive fields are the least diverse. And you know, we can think of art museums and, you know, fashion. You know, if you look at the numbers of, like, who's on those boards of the top fashion companies, people of color, who almost 40% of the population, hold like 11% of the board seats. So if you drill down on all of the fields that are considered so progressive, that's where diversity is most acutely lacking. So, yeah.
And you talk about board seats and how there's such a lack of diversity, but such a desire for diversity that there is recycling.
Right. So they take the same person who's on the Facebook board, and then Uber has a problem, and then they ask them to be on the Uber board, and then another, you know, Starbucks may ask them because they had a little embarrassing episode. And it's like, that's how it works.
As opposed to branching out and seeing who else is out there, because there is a pipeline.
Right.
All right. We're going to go to a Q&A. No speeches, or I'll cut you off. I apologize in advance. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you very much for your really important book.
Thank you.
My question comes from the perspective of academia, because that's the space I'm more familiar with. And I was wondering if you found, in addition to the whole apparatus of diversity that you're talking about, if other benefits come to institutions that promote diversity on the one hand, but don't actually really do it. And I'm speaking from, you know, experience of, you know, grants that are so much easier to obtain when you claim that you are promoting diversity, or people writing papers and people gaining greater visibility. And, you know, what are your thoughts on that part of the business, if you will, aspect of it?
Well, that's interesting, because academia, which I've been on the faculty at New York University for 27 years, it's one of the least diverse places, not just NYU, but academia. African Americans hold 4% of full professors, and that includes at historically black colleges and universities. Latinos are around 3%. The numbers have barely budged in decades. So I don't know who's getting all of these benefits from writing grants, but it's probably not African Americans and Latinos who are hardly visible in the academy. I think there's this perception that we're doing so much better than we are, because I think those of us who are in academia are hyper-visible, and it gives people the sense that there are so many of us, which happens with people of color. It's like there's one or two. It's like so many black people. It's like so many. But yeah, so I can't answer that question. I just know that that's one of the realms of American life that is the least diverse.
Question here?
This is a question, though it's going to be difficult to phrase it correctly. For those of us, and I'm not saying I'm one of these people, even though I try, but for those of us who recognize the distinction between our individuality and how we are forced to come face to face with how we directly and indirectly contribute to the institutional problems and how they contribute to our lives. For those of us who are open-minded enough to recognize it, regardless of race, regardless of class, but don't know how to proceed with that open-mindedness when we find that we have struck a metaphorical wall, do you have any words of advice?
Speak up, stand up. You know, I think, you know, this is a problem that African Americans kind of can't fix. A lot of the issues that I write about, They're not of our making. They're not within our hands to fix. This is a problem that only white Americans, you know, of goodwill, can actually address, talking to people in their own. You know, one of the things that I found, and not just found in researching this book, but what I often write about is that most workplaces are a reflection of our social spheres, and that we're a deeply segregated nation, particularly our social circles, our churches, our schools, we're just so segregated, right? And so that's why I spend so much time writing about portrayals, because I think for many white Americans, they think they know us based on rap music, based on, you know, how we're depicted in films, how we're depicted, you know, just, you know, anywhere you look. And I think those of you who can recognize the inhumanity, the injustice, I mean, it's up to you to call it out as well. I mean, we should not be alone in this battle, because we're talking about just justice, which should concern everyone, right? We're talking about American ideals. We're not talking about black rights. We're talking about human rights. We're talking about just what's right. That's what you can, I mean, I think every day we have an opportunity to do something, a little something, you know? You don't have to, like, march or every day we just have these opportunities arise where we can make a difference just by what we say to someone, how we respond to situations, what we say to our friends and our parents.
But don't you think we're going to see more examples of white people thinking they understand it better than they really do? For all I know, I could be one of them.
Well, that's all I got.
Well, I've got
thank you.
Wait, I've got more for you. So if you haven't read it already, because I don't remember if your hand went up when I asked this question, but I don't think
it did.
White Fragility.
Okay. Yes. Robin DiAngelo. The name of her book is White Fragility. Have you read
I've read it, yes.
Oh, you've read it.
Yes.
So you didn't get... If you don't know about White Fragility, it is a book by a white woman to white people about racism. And it is superb.
It is.
And I thought for sure there would be something in there that would be a roadmap and a guide for you in answering your question. But I do think Pamela is right. The number one thing you can do and the number one thing white Americans can do is to just stand up and speak up when you see something that you know in your heart is unjust, especially if what you see happening is happening to a coworker or a neighbor or even a friend. Because sometimes for those of us, you know, African Americans, when those situations happen, it is lonely. You are at your most vulnerable, and all you would like is for someone
an ally. Yeah.
Right. It's just to say, like, I'm right here.
Mm-hmm.
Or to jump in, like those people did at that Starbucks in Philadelphia.
Precisely.
Who you know,
recorded
pulled out their phones,
it?
They recorded
and
it.
Exactly.
They were telling the police.
Right.
And African Americans spend so much time just sort of relying on ourselves that we're not even expecting anybody to come in as an ally. But the fact that you even just ask that question, and that question is being asked around the country a whole lot more lately over the last 3 years, says to me that as horrible as things are, they're actually a little better, because I think people are tapping into their inner humanity, but also how they can help their friends, colleagues.
And I think it has a lot to do with social media that's documented these things that people never believed us.
Well, right. For generations, we've been saying, police are killing us, and they're planting evidence and stuff like that.
They're
and
doing
they're like,
it,
oh, no, and you're over-exaggerating.
Right.
And which you point out in the book. So
thank you for that
question.
You're welcome. And thank you for the answer.
Thank you.
Now, you were talking before about, are you going to, you have a question, sir?
Oh, no, go make a comment.
No. Please.
I was getting in line.
Ask your question. Ask your question, then I'll bring up my coaching.
So I was just up at the University of Pennsylvania. They had a one-day environmental justice conference, and the first few panels were almost exclusively all white academics talking about environmental justice.
Right.
And it seemed to me like it was a branding opportunity for the University of Pennsylvania to put out their big plan to deal with environmental justice issues nationally and get in front of what is, I think for them, a buzz phrase. Yeah. And I'm wondering how reflective of, I mean, you were talking about the percentages of people of color in academia, how reflective that is of the type of colonization that gets done of places where they think they can go, you know, make money and make a name or brand their school.
Well, it's an example of what I'm talking about, that the most progressive fields, environmental justice, it's not diverse. Like it's almost like, I think the more progressive, it's like we have it covered. Mm-hmm. Like we don't need like diversity because we're progressive. We can do it. And that's typical, though. I mean, I've been to so many conferences over the past 2.5 decades of being in academia where they're talking about the future of news or the future of the environment or the future. And it's like all white people talking about the future. Meanwhile, the demographics are showing that the future doesn't look like those panels.
Can I do an add-on?
Sure.
It's up to Jonathan.
I'm just asking. I don't want to violate any rules. So at this conference, they brought in a person who is the so-called hero of Flint and D.C. and the lead and water crisis, a professor from Virginia Tech, who has won huge numbers of grants and awards, $500,000 awards, $1 million, you know, things like that. And they gave him their imprimatur of the environmental justice guy, but 60 residents from Flint wrote an open letter to the science and engineering community saying, your engagement really didn't work for us. Where is there a place in the United States to lodge a complaint? And where is there a place to have an independent investigation of the type of engagement that's going on? And I feel like there's sort of people stealing narratives and voices and claiming to save communities of color and then reaping all of these benefits and making their career work. And I wonder also if this is, I mean, I know it's not specifically the diversity training piece that you're looking at, but it's just something that I see in the work that we do with communities around the country, that this is going on everywhere.
Well, I think we should always be wary when people are spokespeople for people who are invisible. Mm-hmm. Like, there, you know, we should always be just a little wary. Like, you're speaking for them, but where are they?
Right.
And do they get to have a platform as well?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I've read so, like I said, I've in order, White Fragility, and then I picked up White Rage, and then I pick up Diversity Inc. So I can't remember if you wrote this or if Carol Anderson in White Rage wrote this, but about going to an event where
that was me.
That was you. Going to an event and you're the only one.
Right.
Or one or two.
Yeah. And what was so weird about that one, because it happens all the time. This is New York City, you know.
Right. New York City.
The most diverse city in the world, right? And so I was at a lecture given by a very noted chronicler of the civil rights movement. And after the lecture, the president of this university that shall remain nameless invited about 50 people to a private dinner with the guest of honor. And I'm sitting there, and I'm the only African-American, only person of color, except for the wait staff surrounding the room with their uniforms and trays. And I said, they don't even get the irony that this looked like a scene out of, you know, what he had just recounted,
right,
covering the civil rights movement, covering the segregated South, except this was like 2018, 2017. And the irony was lost on my table guests. I said, look at this. And they were like, what? Yeah, so, I mean, I think many of us professionals have been in that same situation.
Well, not to put the African-Americans on the spot in the room, but just in the last 30 days, have you been at an event where you were the only one in the room, or you could count the number of us on one or two hands? Yes, and okay, all people of color.
Well, it happens, yeah.
Right, and when I was starting my career, and I was like, oh, I'm this young kid. I'm looking around the room. It's like, wow, I'm the only one. But things are going to get better. Things, you know, it's going to, and here we are in 2019,
precisely.
And I'm still walking into rooms, looking around,
right,
and seeing I'm the only one.
Right, and diverse cities, and cities where there is a sizable number of people of color.
The silver lining in this sort of sad story is that now when my husband goes to events and he's, you know, white redhead from North Dakota, he goes to events and he will come home and say, I'm tired of going to these, you know, non-diverse events. There were no people of color, or there was one person of color. So I take that as a
sign,
you know,
of progress.
A sign of progress. Tiny,
yeah. But you
sign
know,
of
but,
progress.
The, but just before we close, mm-hmm. that is what I'm talking about. It's okay. People should socialize with whomever they want to, but that is perpetuating these exclusionary workplaces, because that's who you recommend for a job. That's who your friends will recommend. So that's the problem is not that people are not choosing to socialize across the racial lines. The problem is that it perpetuates inequality and injustice in segregated workplaces.
And this is the perfect paragraph to end on, and it's early in the book. I'm not going to tell you the page because I need you to buy the book so you can see it. But you write, unless and until white America, including those who claim progressive values, comes to terms with its complicity in persisting injustice, diversity initiatives will continually fail. Pamela Newkirk, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
This
oh my
important
God.
Book.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.